Welcome to the Book a Week podcast, jointly hosted by the SEPT University Library and the Center for Research on Architecture and Urbanism.
I'm Samini Raja, alumna of SEPT University, currently head of the Department of the Institute of Design. I also serve as Director of Research at Studio Community Kerala. Today, the author in conversation is Professor Dr. Amita Babaskar, who authored the seminal work Uncivil City, Ecology, Equity, and the Commons in Delhi. Amita Babaskar is a professor of Environmental Studies and Sociology and Anthropology at Ashoka University, Delhi. Her research and teaching address the cultural politics of environment and development in rural and urban India. And she focuses on the role of social inequality and identities in natural resource contracts. Currently, she is working on the politics of food and changing agrarian environment in Madhya Pradesh and studying the social experience of air pollution in Delhi.
So, hi, Amita. Thank you for joining us today. It is an honor to have you here as part of the Book a Week podcast. So when a friend actually suggested this book to me, I was mentioning this to you over the phone. I really didn't think twice before I picked it up because it has been simply amazing reading this book, a thrilling experience. And I've always enjoyed your writing and also enjoyed literature on Delhi. So I literally wanted to, sort of underline every sentence that you wrote in this book. And most importantly, made me very guilty about some of the concepts that I used to nurture and think that I'm an environmentalist. So thank you so much for this wonderful book of yours. And for the listeners of this podcast, this is a must read for architects and urban planners and urban designers to make sense of urban complexity that is brought through this book from multiple perspectives. Delhi, as we all know, is a very unique cultural geography with its everyday politics affecting every aspect of its being and becoming of a city. So to start with, the title of your book, Uncivil City, could you throw some light on how and why this title and why Delhi? For those who have read it, we know why Delhi, but for those who haven't yet, why Delhi?
Well, Somini, first of all, thank you for inviting me to the podcast and for the kind things you said about the book. I'm so happy that you enjoyed reading it because I enjoyed writing it very much. I've been born and brought up in Delhi. So my, writing about the book is as much a process of trying to understand my love for the city, which has grown more and more difficult over the years. And part of that love is simply the fond memories you have because of that association with place. This is what we did when we were young. This is what we did when we were growing up. And this is, your own story is linked up with the places of a city, the people in a city. But Delhi, as I think even those of us who are Delhi Walas or Delhi Walis will, have to acknowledge, is pretty much an unlivable city most of the time. And it's to do with the, one, the sheer density and crowdedness of a place, which has now become somewhat pathological in our inability to make that density something which is always joyful and productive. The frictions that the city throws up, we haven't found a way of, doing something interesting or innovative in terms of living with them. On the other hand, we've gone the other way. So I think that it's not just to do with the problems of congestion and pollution and the ways in which people don't manage to get along the ways in which injustice and inequality is blatant in your face and seems to be taken for granted, even deepening. I think all of that is part of what informs my relationship with Delhi and my gradual self-awareness that I'm a pretty privileged place. I'm in a pretty privileged place because of my own social location as an, you know, upper middle class person. And that a lot of the problems of Delhi are actually created by the class to which I belong. So how does one come to terms with that complicity in creating the problems that, you know, snarl up and besiege the city, while also trying to get beyond that and do something that is a positive and constructive way of resolving those issues? So those are the kinds of dilemmas that I have grappled with. And why uncivil city? I think most people who come to Delhi from somewhere else immediately are struck by its rudeness, its aggression, by just how violent it is, especially towards women. And what is it that allows us to be in a city and yet not think of everyone as citizens, as people who are more or less, if not equal, at least deserving of some degree of respect and tolerance? And so that focus on the lack of civility came quite late to me, because I was thinking about civil society and the way in which civil society organizations, NGOs, etc., are supposed to be working to create a better city. But I found that many of them, in fact, were ignoring a critical part of the problem, which was the way in which their own sense of what a better city is were actually informed by their own class privileges and their own class perspective. So I thought civil society as a place where people of all kinds get together and collectively claim the city as citizens is actually not working. And then just as I was putting the essays together, I stumbled across this literature on civility, which actually comes from people working on Dalit politics. And I said, you know, oh, this really clicks. Because here, civility isn't something that is necessarily a part of just citizenship. It's not something that you claim vis-a-vis the state. Civility is something you claim vis-a-vis other fellow citizens. You know, your claim to respect, your right to be heard, your right to be able to claim a place in the city. And all of these things that led me to think about the many different layers of thinking about what it means to be civil and why Delhi is uncivil. So the uncivil city part was actually what fell into place for me very much at the end, because earlier I was thinking only in terms of citizenship, of claims against the state. And then I realized that, yeah, claims against the state are so important, but so is our own relationship to others around us.
So in this particular book, you have looked at homes, you've looked at workplaces, trees, rivers, ridges, and even non-human beings. And all of these come together through three main chapters, three main thematic sections, which I feel are very cleverly organized, which is offering a peek into the different aspects of Delhi that you grew up in as a citizen. So for the benefit of the students who might be actually listeners of this podcast, could you discuss the thought behind these, you know, three major sections? How did you come about creating these three major sections?
Okay, well, you know, the three major sections, the first one is called Remaking Landscapes and Life. And the second is called Contesting the Commons. And the third is a conclusion and coda, which looks at the city today and how environmental arguments and environmental struggles in the city are framed and what that means for us today as well as in the future, given how climate change is just complicating and reconfiguring so much. These essays, for the most part, are also chronological. They're in the sequence in which I wrote them. So in some ways, what they also do is show my growing understanding and changing understanding of how these processes happen and what matters in the city. So in some ways, if you read the first essay and then you read the last essay, they'll seem very odd because they represent very different points in my journey towards, you know, an evolving understanding of how cities work, what matters, what doesn't. I think what always mattered to me since I was a school kid was a concern about the environment. And I was lucky enough to be able to, in a way, sharpen that concern from a simple, you know, appreciation of nature, that I like trees, I like birds, into something which was more home to the way in which nature fitted into people's livelihoods, especially in rural India, and the ways in which there was a huge development machinery at work that destroyed nature just as it destroyed the livelihoods of very poor people in the country. And my first piece of research was on Adivasis in the Narmada Valley who were fighting against the Sardar Sarovar Dam that eventually displaced them. So this is a common thread of social justice and environmental sustainability that runs through all my essays. But at the very beginning, when I was thinking about remaking landscapes and lives, the first essay that I wrote came out of a series of events that were happening in Delhi, which were to do with just demolishing a huge set of working class dwellings, slum busties, squatter settlements that happened to be illegal. And remarkably, there was very little coverage of this in the newspapers. I mean, we're talking about lakhs of people in the middle of summer, their homes where they'd lived for 20, 25 years being demolished. And they're being left out in the sun with, you know, kids, nothing left to them. And I began to wonder about the grounds on which such evictions happened. And what was very clear in the court orders which led to these evictions, that it wasn't just about, hey, these people are occupying illegal lands. It was also an argument about these people are standing in the way of clean and green Delhi. So that environmental aspect, you know, what's a clean and green Delhi that everybody wants to live in? What's the place of poor people and workers in that city? And how does our middle-class quest for clean cleanliness and greenery result in this huge devastation of people's lives? Those were the questions that first began to bother me. And then it also became apparent that the way I thought about nature in the Narmada Valley, that there's the Narmada River, she's sacred, there are these beautiful forests of teak and other species. Here are Adivasis who live and, you know, farm on these lands. Those ideas of poor people's engagement with nature couldn't be seen in a city. So how did poor people relate to the Yamuna floodbanks? Very different from the Narmada. Okay, they didn't cultivate there, but they lived there and their homes mattered to them. So what does it mean to have that entitlement to place recognized in one place and completely just dismissed in the other, so that you can be, but in both cases, you get, you know, violent displacement. So I began with those questions, and this thing of, you know, what is nature in the city soon then began to really trouble me, because my childhood idea that nature is, you know, we want trees and we want shady roads and we want our little patches of wetland to be protected, I soon came to expand that and see that nature means, or the environment means, very different things to people of different classes. And that while it's terrifically important to love trees and birds and create a space for other species in the city, we have to also be aware of the ways in which our other actions are actually shrinking those spaces. Be it, you know, I talk about it in the book, our love affair with automobiles, the ways in which, you know, cars, the expansion of roads is changing what our streets are like. It's making things hostile for a number of other people as well. Everybody from the disabled to the elderly and so on. But then it also made me realize that certain kinds of middle-class campaigns are incredibly powerful because they manage to appeal to the media, they manage to appeal to the courts, but because they have a huge blind spot in terms of their class privilege, all sorts of really urgent urban issues, such as who has access to water, who has access to urban space, who ends up using most of the resources in the city. So those are the sorts of contradictions between social justice and sustainability that then shaped the work. So I began by, to again go back to the structure of the book, first talking about the decision by the courts to close down factories in Delhi and to remove slums in Delhi. And I looked at how those were what I call decisions that were partial, particularistic, and perverse. Partial in the truths that they recognized, particularistic in the kinds of effects they had in terms of which class benefited, which classes lost out, and perverse because they actually ended up worsening the environmental problem they claimed to be addressing. So I started with that, and then I developed this further the idea of the commons and city spaces such as the river, the ridge, the range of the Aravallis that runs through the city, which for much of it is forested, how that's used.
Thank you. It's really interesting because I remember while I was doing my field work about 10 years back, I was in Kutch and we visited about 45 villages along the Kutch coast. And in one of those areas, there was a cement industry that was getting constructed. And so what they would do is they would throw sand onto the mangrove patch. The nematophores will get disrupted and they would die. And then they would claim it as a wasteland. And on the other hand, they would say that they will plant some hundreds of trees as part of their CSR funding and stuff like that. So these are some of the images that came to my mind while I was reading this book, and precisely the question as to we are uncivil in that sense everywhere, you know. So thank you for that very crisp answer. And so coming to the next part, where, as you mentioned, you know, these are essays that you have penned over a period of time, probably a couple of decades, it has taken. What has been the process behind bringing them into this book? In a sense, recording a city over a period of time would definitely require a methodical approach that is both rigorous from an anthropological perspective, and also it is a very personal matter from a citizen's perspective. So could you give some insights on the methodology that you followed to build this process or this incredible scholarship on Delhi?
Well, I've been trained to do, you know, close ethnographic work. And in some ways, the research I did in the Narmada Valley, which was then published as a book, In the Belly of the River, was that kind of classic village study. I went and I lived in an Adivasi village for 1 year on the banks of the Narmada. I learned Bhilali, their language, and I did everything that people did to the extent that I could And it was, you know, classic participant observation. Now, Delhi and research in Delhi posed a set of challenges there because Delhi was my home. And I worked in Delhi and I thought I knew the city because, you know, I've grown up with it. It's all around me. So that position of being the outsider, which was there in the Adivasi village I lived in, Anjanwara, where because you're a stranger, everything is unfamiliar, so you sort of, you know, look at it through fresh eyes. That wasn't the case in Delhi. Everything was familiar. What though shook me out of that sense of maybe, you know, complacency about the city was when I became aware of a particular incident that happened where the police fired on a group of slum dwellers quite close to my house. And the incident which I describe in the book is to do with one of those slum dwellers using an open area to defecate. And the people, the well-to-do people of that area, you know, just beating him to death for having done that. And then I discovered when I went to that area, that very close to where I lived was a Delhi I knew nothing about. There was this huge settlement of workers next to the railway lines, next to an industrial estate. And even though this is, you know, 4 or 5 kilometers from my house, I'd never been to that industrial estate. I'd never even known about the existence of this particular settlement because there's a particular middle-class way of inhabiting the city where, you know, my social geography took me to particular places. And I was just blissfully unaware that there is this other city with which, you know, I live in close proximity and which also affects my life in various ways. That, you know, those are the people who live in that particular basti are the ones who where the domestic workers for our areas come from and so on. So the challenge was therefore to realize that there's a Delhi that I know nothing about. And I need to figure out ways of learning about this Delhi, which I was able to do thanks to, in the beginning, you know, a couple of NGOs who worked with in working class settlements. It was then also because in the early 1990s or mid-1990s, there came to be a group, a coalition of different kinds of organizations, trade unions, NGOs, working on Delhi called Sajha Manch. So through them, I got access to a number of places and people I wouldn't have otherwise been able to know about. The second difficulty was also that when you're living in a village, which is a small village, it seems like a very contained universe. You feel, I'm going to know all the people, I'm going to learn all about their relationships. Of course, that's, you know, a conceit. It's a fiction of that seeming smallness. But it at least gives you a working sense of, you know, okay, this is what I have to focus on. But in Delhi now, it's a huge city, right? 16 million people and more. How do you carve out a way of figuring out something about the city and which is still saying something significant, but there's no way in which you can cover it in its entirety? So I can't do field work all over the city. I can't even do that sort of, you know, park myself in a basti and, you know, pretend I'm one of them. Because people know that, you know, she lives somewhere else. And the very point is that, you know, there's a connection between where I live and where they live and so on. So what I then chose to do was, it might be called, you know, sort of more spotty ethnography in the sense that there were particular areas that I concentrated on where I spent time, significant amount of time, just kind of hanging out, but also then doing detailed interviews with people over time, over several years, in fact, seeing what happened to them. Some of these are people who had been displaced and thrown on the outskirts of the city. Over the time that I knew them. They built pakka houses. They got bus services. That outskirt of the city became, you know, just a regular working class neighborhood on the edges of the city. But the city had grown so much that they, in fact, were now quite respectable property owners. So some of their fortunes also changed. So I depended also a lot because some of these things were happening at the macro level. So I depended a lot also on newspaper reports, on court judgments, on following what was happening with particular cases, the arguments that were made. So there was a kind of, you know, textual content analysis that I had to do as well. So there was, I had to kind of constantly, you know, tack back and forth between the local and the grounded, between the, you know, the macro or the scale of the media, the judicial discourse, government orders, government practices on the ground, as well as plans up above of making Delhi a world-class city. And I try to draw as self-consciously as possible on my own knowledge of the city and how it had changed. So there's a strong element of, you know, an autobiography also in these pages. And I hope it's not self-indulgent. I hope it's not, you know, uncritical in the sense that, you know, I'm aware of my privileges and the position from which I speak. And I also hope it's not too sentimental. But, you know, I can't claim to be neutral. The topic is too close to my heart.
Yeah, yeah. One of your arguments, I mean, or probably the primary argument in this book is where you have stated, speaking from what you wrote, is that the power to define and deal with an issue is an as an environmental problem is unequally distributed. So given this argument of yours and the very strong critiquing of bourgeois or environmentalism vis-a-vis the, you know, everyday urban practice, could you throw some light on these?
You know, I developed this phrase bourgeois environmentalism as a counter to the way in which environmentalism is widely regarded by everybody. Most people who are progressive think of environmentalists as good guys, right? We're on the side of the environment, we're on the side of Mother Nature, Mother Earth, and so on. And in the Indian case in particular, we believe that because India has had a very rich and continuing tradition of what is called the environmentalism of the poor, be it the Chipko movement and village women hugging trees in order to save them from being cut, be it the Narmada Bachao Andolan with very poor Adivasis fighting to save a riverine ecosystem, their lives, their culture, and so on. We've always associated environmentalism as being the good guys. And it was therefore, in some ways, my need to differentiate that kind of good environmentalism, which combines social justice issues with ecological sustainability, with that particularly blinkered kind of environmentalism that I saw a lot of middle-class groups participate in. These were the resident welfare associations who would say, we want a clean Delhi, so, you know, appeal to the court to get rid of the slum next to their house because slums are dirty. Without getting into why are people living in the slum in the first place? Do they actually like living in that slum? Do they like having their children defecate on the footpaths? What is it that the residents of the slum are providing you in terms of cheap domestic, you know, workers and so on? So it is that kind of almost cosmetic environmentalism, which says, you know, the city is too congested. Let's ban cycle rickshaws. Now, you know, you can ban cycle rickshaws because you see them as unsafe. But what about your cars? What about the fact that creating just sheer parking space for cars has ended up destroying pavements, cutting down trees, a whole set of things that you would otherwise be against? Besides, of course, a huge thing of, you know, fuel guzzling and carbon emissions and contributing to climate change and so on. So there's a way in which the phrase bourgeois environmentalism for me was important to, one, distinguish it from ecological justice movements, and second, to point out that the role of the middle class in furthering environmental causes has often been somewhat pernicious. And a lot of, I think, middle class people get it, which is why those, many of them make common cause and are in solidarity with other kinds of justice movements, be it Dalit issues, be it, you know, workers' rights to housing and so forth. So not every person who is middle class is necessarily a bourgeois environmentalist. Bourgeois environmentalists are those whose idea of the environment is about creating order, creating a sanitized space for their enjoyment of a particular kind of lifestyle. And if in creating that order, it means trampling over the rights of other people, other living things, they're fine with that.
Yeah, it's actually very interesting where you speak about a solution to the city, because oftentimes it's architects, urban planners, urban designers who sort of shoulder the responsibility of building infrastructure for the future. And probably, again, going back to your writing there, you're critiquing the idea of world-class infrastructure. In this book, you have discussed at large on value that is attributed to ecology and the role of disasters in it. And so we are also living in a time when we are encountering various different forms of disasters, climate uncertainties across the country. So what does urban infrastructure really mean given these uncertainties for future?
So part of what perplexed me about studying Delhi as opposed to studying in the Narmada Valley was that you know, in the Narmada Valley there was a very strong people's movement, people coming together, fighting for themselves. What was puzzling in Delhi and, you know, kind of hard for me because, you know, I wanted to find a cause and help fight for it, was that there was no such social movement. And then that was the reason why I became very interested in why is it that people can't find a common cause and come together to fight for a more equitable share of land, or to fight against the things that hurt everybody, like the horrible air pollution we have that is, you know, crippling children and killing off people prematurely and so on. This idea that with disasters, we get what are binding crises, that everybody is affected, in fact, doesn't quite work the way it should in a country that is as deeply unequal as India is, and where the well-to-do, the well-connected always have an escape clause. And that escape clause is you can buy your way out of a problem. You buy air purifiers for your home. When it's Diwali, you go off into the hills because you want to escape the smoke. Those are the sorts of things. Or, you know, water quality. Everybody who has a water purifier in their house, like I do, has basically said, I don't actually care about the quality of tap water. So that means that poor people who can't afford filtered water are left to fend for themselves, because we don't have a common cause even around such a basic thing, which is municipal water, that most people are able to get. Well, more or less. Some people don't get that municipal water either. So given all of that, how do we come together to create a more just city? I think, you know, often these are going to be, again, conjunctures and accidental ones, which we can't really plan for, but where we have to be able to seize the unexpected opportunity that opens up. I can't be more specific than that, but point to, I'm trying to think of, you know, what are the other cases where something like this has happened, where there has been, okay, one example, Chicago in the 1990s had a major heat wave. It's a subject of a book by Robert Kleinenberg. In that heat wave, they found that the people who died, by and large, were elderly African-Americans living in particular neighborhoods of the city that were underserviced. And they died because their electricity gave out, because all the people in the well-to-do areas were cranking up their ACs. And they also died because they had little social support, and they had no common spaces like a library or a swimming pool where they could go and cool off. But after realizing that this was a social pattern of this calamity, which was caused by the heat wave, but actually exacerbated by the social relations around race and class and age, then there was a concerted bid to try and say, well, how do we make sure that this doesn't happen again? And these particularly vulnerable people are not ghettoized and denied access to basic services. So it started a wider conversation about welfare, about housing, about, you know, differences in the city. I hope we can do the same thing. I see that happening in cities like Chennai, where a lot of the work that the Vetiver Collective has done around the issue of flooding is just superb in terms of making the connections between who got flooded, who didn't, why the floods happened in the ways they did, how what was a natural, quote-unquote, natural disaster, but exacerbated by climate change, was also shaped by the social patterns of how we use space, who lives where. And they've done similar things about, you know, the commons in the city through their work on, you know, Parambok and the Ennore Creek and so on. So I see those are signs of great hope, where students come together with local communities, come together with people who work in media, you know, amazing stuff, creative stuff with music and, you know, video, animation, all of that.
I think I've taken a lot of your time, but I think I'll just end with one last question. In the book, somewhere closer to the conclusion chapter, you've sort of written, quote, open, when green is confined to the solitary tree that has survived in a wasteland, or a densely packed settlement, or the suicide plant growing in a recycled gym, urban nature is conspicuous by its absence. What is your advice to young urban practitioners and policymakers?
My advice, I'm really bad at giving advice, you know, because I always feel that I'm learning and I'm making mistakes and, you know, trying to learn from those mistakes. So I've never felt that I'm in a position to be able to offer advice to others. So what I'd say is be curious and keep your minds and eyes open to connections. Try and see the world in all its wonderful complexity. And don't worry if you can't immediately solve something, if you can't come up with a solution.
Thank you so much, Amita, for spending your evening with us. It has been a pleasure talking to you, again, listening to you for this particular podcast. Thank you so much, and I wish you all the very best. And looking forward to more writing from you on cities in India and shortly sometimes outside of India. So all the very best to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you so many. I really enjoyed this. So thank you for your questions. They were very, very astute and hit all the high points. So thanks for inviting me.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. Do not miss to like, share, and subscribe to our podcast. Available on all your favorite podcast apps.